Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today we will have continuation for the health licensing boards and their budget requests. We have dentistry up first. Then we're going to have nutrition, podiatric medicine, nursing, and psychology. So if we could start out with dentistry, that'd be great. Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bridget Anderson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. And I know you got to meet with some of my colleagues in the weeks prior to this, but we are actually one of the other 15 health licensing boards for the state of Minnesota. The mission of our board, the Board of Dentistry, is to promote and protect public health and safety and to ensure that every licensed dental professional in the state meets the requirements for safe, ethical, and competent care. The Minnesota Board of Dentistry licenses and regulates all the dental professionals, so that includes dentists, dental therapists, dental hygiene, and dental assisting for the state of Minnesota. We have 9 members, and 5 of those members are licensed dentists, 2 are licensed allied dental professionals, 1 being a dental hygienist, 1 being a dental assistant, and the other 2 are public members. Our full board meets quarterly. We also have several committee meetings every month. We do, among some of those examples, we do have 2 complaint committees. We also have policy committees, licensing and credentialing, and other professional development and so forth. The board office is staffed by 10 full-time staff members and also 1 part-time staff member. At present, the Board of Dentistry licenses and regulates a total of 17,422 dental professionals in the state. The licensees include about 4,000 dentists and 13,000 allied dental professionals. I want to talk more about our budget items. The change items are included in pages 5 to 7 of the dentistry budget in front of you. And they explain the details of the governor's recommendations to address the board's need for adequate funding. To continue the regulation of the dental professionals in an effective manner, the board does collect sufficient funding for this through the fees paid to our board. No fee increases are required at this time beyond the current statutory authority that we have. On behalf of the Board of Dentistry, I would like to express support for the governor's budget recommendations and the 2 change items included. These include, 1, pages 5 and 6 in your materials, a small agency operational increase for $72,000 in fiscal 18-19 and for $84,000 in fiscal 2021. This small agency operational increase will help us address cost increases related to salary adjustments for current staff, rent and office space needs, employee development opportunities and training, and for ongoing utilization of our dental reviewer for record keeping and investigative purposes. 2, the information technology services and the database management that's on page 7 of your materials. The board supports the governor's recommendation of $48,000 for the biennially, for the minute, which is our information technology operation expenses. This includes our funding for network switches for the secure transfer of information. It includes voicemail, email, and phone. Also other IT devices as needed for our board, the maintenance of those devices, and then also a service level agreement increases and expenses. That's all I have today. I really invite you to support the change items. It helps us further our mission, and it's in the best interest of public health and safety and dentistry in Minnesota. And by approving the recommended increases in the board's budget, this will help us achieve that. That concludes my comments. I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Are there questions on the proposed budget changes for the dental board? Once again, that there's no licensing fee changes at all within that?
Not within our current statutory authority. We actually are not at the top level at the moment.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Yep. Are you going to stay where you are, or are you going to?
We actually have a dietetics board, but I will remain.
All right. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Next up, we have dietetics and nutrition practice. Ruth Grendel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My My name is Ruth Bendel. I'm the executive director for both the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice, and what's next on the agenda, the Board of Podiatric Medicine. They're 0.5 FTE for both positions. The Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice is responsible for protection of the public through licensure of dietitians and nutritionists. The board was established in 1995, and currently Minnesota has 1,794 licensed dietitians and nutritionists, a significant increase from just 2 years ago. Dietitians and nutritionists are food and nutrition experts who integrate and apply the scientific principles of food, nutrition, biochemistry, physiology, food management, and behavioral and social sciences, helping to achieve and maintain healthcare goals. They work throughout our communities in hospitals, schools, medical clinics, nursing homes, fitness centers, food industry, universities, research, and private practice. You may be familiar with our board chair, Deb Sheets, who is an assistant professor at St. Kate's, teaching nutrition science, dietetics, and family and consumer science, and often a featured media guest commenting on emerging issues in the field. The seven board members are appointed by the governor and consist of three public members, two licensed dietitians, and two licensed nutritionists. Board members are committed to operating efficiently. We continue to operate with the same staffing since 1995, less than one full-time equivalent at 0.88. The executive director is 0.5 and a 0.3 office specialist. Electronic processes allow us to offer online applications and online renewals, resulting in efficiencies. We renewed 1,740 licensees in FY17, and 96% of them were completed online. 93 new applications so far in FY17, and only 5 are on paper. We still have a few who refuse to put their credit cards online. The board is required to collect sufficient revenue to cover both direct and indirect expenditures and has not raised the fees since set in statute over 20 years ago. The two change items this year is a small agency operating increase to fund the operational expenses. Over the past 8 years, increases have been at 9% or less than 1% a year. The other one is for what you've heard about information technology that we are all putting into our budget now for IT costs, when in the past we used to use at the end of the biennium and spend what we needed for computers. No fee increases is required for these changes, Mr. Chair and committee members. That completes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions on dietetics? All right. Seeing none, do you want to go ahead and follow?
Yes, jump right in. Thank you. Once again, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm here representing the Board of Minnesota Board of Podiatric Medicine. My name is Ruth Randall. The Board of Podiatric Medicine, or Board of Chiropody, then was created by the legislature 100 years ago in 1917 with the purpose of regulating the right to practice and scope of practice for doctors of podiatric medicine who are licensed to diagnose and treat ailments of the human foot, ankle, and lower leg. Last year, the legislature passed licensure requirements for the orthotic, prosthetic, and podiatric professions, creating an advisory council, and the board became the administrative agency for those professions. The mission of the board is to protect the public by regulating the privilege to practice podiatric medicine to qualified applicants and by investigating complaints relating to the competency or behavior of individual licensees. The board has seven members appointed by the governor and is comprised of two public members and 5 DPM licensed to practice in Minnesota. Dr. Stephen Paulus, a DPM surgeon with ParkNicolet, currently serves as the board as the board president. There are currently 237 licensed DPMs in Minnesota, and that's about a 28% increase since I started with the board 7 years ago. This trend is likely to continue as the demand for DPM is expected to increase with the aging population of the state. Minnesota has 3 institutions offering rigorous 3-year residency programs. The sponsoring institutions are Alliance Mercy Hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, and Regents Hospital. There are currently 19 temporary permits in Minnesota, of which 3 are from Michigan. They do a rotation at the Douglas County Hospital with the St. John Hospital Medical Center out of Detroit. Of the 5 temporary permits that have completed their 3-year residency or will in June, I've already heard from 3 of them that have positions in Minnesota and are inquiring about full licensure. The board is entirely fee-funded, receiving no general fund dollars. It's responsible for collecting sufficient revenue to cover both direct and indirect expenditures and has not raised the fees since 1999. We only are in for 1 change item, and that is for the IT cost that you've already heard about. And it will result in no fee increases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have questions? All right. Seeing no questions, thank you. Next up, we have nursing. Shirley Brecken. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. As Mr. Chair said, I am Shirley Brecken. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing, and I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today and regarding the Board's appropriation requests for 2018 and 2019. I know you have materials in front of you. The board profile is included on page one, so I'm not going to reiterate any of that for you. But before I address the change items the board is requesting, I want to acknowledge that this is a big ask. We've not come forward with an ask such as this for, I can't remember, I don't know what I ever have. But we are a big board. We regulate over 22,000 licensed practical nurses, 105,000 registered nurses, and nearly 8,000 APRNs. In fact, we regulate the practice of the largest group of health professionals in the state. If you were to add up the other healthcare professionals that are regulated by the health licensing boards, they would probably not total the number of nurses in the state. I want to preface my comments about the requested change items by letting you know the board has sufficient reserves to fund them without any increase in fees. The license renewal fee for nurses is $85 every 2 years, and that was last raised in 2001. Often we are asked how the fee compares to other states, and while it's difficult to admit to being average, that's just that this is one time that Minnesota is average as far as the fee is for nurse licenses. The change items fall basically into four areas: operating increases, staffing, a major technology project, and space. I know you have the details of each of the change items in front of you, so I will discuss them only briefly and then stand for any questions that you have. Operations, which you find on pages 5 through 7, is what's commonly known as a small agency increase, which includes increases in salaries and benefits and hardware and software purchases according to an established replacement schedule. Also included are increases in rates for technology services from Minute, such as voicemail, data storage, and security. On pages 8 and 9, you'll find information related to staffing increases that we are requesting. We are, first of all, requesting funding an assistant director, which has not been filled for several years as a cost-saving measure. In fact, I became the executive director in 1999, and prior to that, I was the associate executive director, and that position has been vacant since that time. There is increased expectation of the board to be involved in activities such as workforce policy development, nursing practice issues related to public health, such as the opioid crisis, and a changing healthcare system. And quite candidly, I don't have the time any longer to give the attention that we should be giving to those areas. The board would like to add two individuals in our licensure group. This group has not been increased in over 15 years. The number of licensees has increased from 87,000 in 2001 to over 127,000 today. The group processes nearly 9,000 licenses a year compared to 1,300 in 2001 and over 62,000 renewals annually. Unfortunately, our response times are increasing, and while the staff prides itself on being responsive and providing good service, we're finding that more difficult to do. Data has become a major service area for the board, and a research analyst is needed to provide the kind of information for workforce planning, performance improvement, audits, state and national databases, process efficiencies, and evidence to support regulatory practices and services. We plan to share this position with other health-related boards as they need it through interagency agreements. Pages 10 and 11 include the information regarding our technology project. The board is nearing completion of phase one of, the replacement of our database and regulatory management system, which has been in operation for over 20 years. Phase one has been a build of the new database, licensure and accounting system, and online services. Phase two will be a replacement to the discipline case management system, which will include complaint intake, tracking of the complaint processing, and a workflow. This is a one-time cost request and will not add to the base budget. Pages 12 and 13 include the request for funding for space. And again, this is this one is a mixed cost assignment in that some is a one-time cost for building new workspace and an increase to the base budget for rental increase. It is the big ask, with the majority being the build-out and furnishing. In addition to the board's individual space increase is an increase of approximately 1,000 square feet to the major conference rooms that is shared by all the boards for our board meetings and other public meetings. Pages 14 and 15 is an ask of a different sort, and that is a budget reduction to the Board of Nursing of $218,000. Currently, the BUD solely funds these two staff persons through that work for a minute, although they are shared staff with the other health licensing boards. By consolidating the expense of all the IT staff within the shared ASU, we will more fairly reflect the service expenses. All the boards will pay for the services of all the IT staff on a billable hour system. I close with these comments. As you know, the board is fee-funded and receives no general fund dollars. We have not raised fees in 16 years and do not have a need to do so now. The board has sufficient reserves. In fact, the reserves are projected to be approximately $8,500,000 at the end of 2019, and we have sufficient reserves to fund these requests and still maintain that recommended reserve. I like to think that we have saved until we could afford to fund these items rather than buy them on credit and raise fees to pay the bill. Thank you for your attention, and I am happy to stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Beckman. Is there any questions on the board nursing? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Beckman. I'm wondering, what of the health licensing boards or other boards are co-located in the shared space, and can that be maximized? I wasn't quite sure if I understood what you're proposing in terms of changes.
Ms. Beckett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, you are correct. All of the health-related licensing boards, in fact, 15 of us are co-located in the same building. It's a rental building on University Avenue. We do share administrative services, such as purchasing and payroll and accounting through a voluntary, actually now mandated, administrative services unit, and the payment for those services is sort of on a pro rata basis. The bigger you are, the more you pay for those services. Additionally, we share some common space. We have three conference rooms that we share. The largest, of course, is the one that we use for our public meetings and board meetings. That space for some of the boards, the smaller boards, is quite sufficient. It is not sufficient for the Board of Nursing. We have a situation where I'm not sure how happy sometimes the fire marshal would be if he or she were to come into that space. So that by expanding that space, the board of, because it's the Board of Nursing that needs that additional space, that's why we have put it into our appropriations request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know enough about how often your board meets and those sorts of things, but I know that there are some new public rooms that are quite large with great design in the new Capitol building that are reservable from any group, and you might want to look at least until you can get this. That might be an option for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, thank you for that suggestion.
All right, other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Brecken. And next up, we have Psychology Board.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Ms. Angela Barnes.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angelina Barnes. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology. The board is, of course, one of the 15 health-related licensing boards that regulate licensed healthcare professionals in the state of Minnesota. We model the same operational structure of the other health licensing boards, including appointment of members by the Office of the Governor and the inclusion of public members representing consumer interests on the board. We have a general statutory structure for receipt and investigation of consumer complaints that we share with other health-related licensing boards, as well as the use of the Administrative Services Unit, the Criminal Background Check Program Services, and the Health Professional Services Program, which is a diversion program for providers who may be unable to practice with reasonable skill and safety. The board is funded by application and service fees deposited in the state government special revenue fund and receives no general fund tax dollars to support its operations. The Minnesota Board protects the public by implementing a three-prong approach. We first rely on education. We believe in the development, implementation, and delivery of a collaborative educational program to educate the public, institutions, graduate students, psychology interns, training directors, postdocs, supervisors, and those seeking licensure on the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act. We then look at regulation, and we operate a comprehensive regulatory program, including receipt and investigation of complaints against unlicensed practices of psychology, applicants or licensees, and we also have the complaint resolution structure under Chapter 14 using the Administrative Procedures Act. We have the ability to issue discipline and corrective action to address violations of the Practice Act, and to prevent unethical or incompetent practice of psychology by unqualified individuals, licensed or otherwise. Finally, we work through licensure, one of our primary functions, and we also serve as a primary source verification for education, training, and experience to multiple third-party credentialing entities, hospitals, and employers. The Board of Psychology itself was established in 1974. We license licensed psychologists. We regulate professional psychological firms, continuing education sponsors, and guest licenses. The board has 11 members, 3 licensed psychologists with doctoral degrees in psychology, 2 licensed psychologists with master's degrees in psychology, 1 general licensed psychologist, and 3 public members. We're staffed by 8.5 full-time staff employees, but despite having one license type, Minnesota psychologists regulated by the board vary significantly in their education, training, and background. If an applicant were to seek licensure today, the entry-level degree for a psychologist is a doctoral degree in psychology. However, Minnesota's current workforce and mental health providers of the psychologists that we license are diverse because Minnesota used to license master's-level individuals. Our current composition, we regulate 1,520 doctoral-level licensed psychologists who hold a PhD in psychology. That could be clinical, educational, organizational, or counseling. We regulate 977 doctoral-level licensed psychologists with a PsyD, 865 master's-level licensed psychologists with a Master's of Art degree, 295 are Master's of Science degree, and then we have 151 psychologists, or 4% of all of our active licenses, hold, I'll call it another form of degree. It's a mix. We do have some pastoral counseling. We have some holdover school psychology, educational backgrounds, and so we do have those 151 individuals who are grandfathered in. 468 continuing education sponsors. So for a total, we regulate 4,276 active licenses or registrations. The board's appropriation in fiscal year 16 is $862,000, the same for fiscal year 17. Our budget is largely devoted to staff, as well as salaries, office rent, supplies, and equipment. The board supports the change item included in the governor's budget for our agency, which would result in a $1.243 million budget in FY 18 and 19. We have a variety of change items included in the packet in pages 1 through 12, particularly 6 through 12 address our change items. I can provide additional information if necessary on the change items. Many of them mirror what the other health boards are looking for, particularly in minute and IT services, staffing. One of our unique ones is educational programming. We do a lot in the graduate programs as well as offering free continuing education. Otherwise, that would conclude my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you the work of the staff and board members of the Board of Psychology who bring with them each day a commitment to serve the state of Minnesota. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Barnes, I'm looking over the work of the Board of Psychology over the last year and note a very substantial increase in the number of complaints that have occurred, and I'm just have a number of questions with regard to those. The first question relevant to that is what was the genesis for those complaints? Were they extraneous or internal to the organization?
Yes, Mr.
Chair and Senator Albright. The board regulates, obviously, both licensure and compliance matters. So we look at the rules of conduct as well as licensure. And so we had significant staffing changes. I arrived in 2009. And with those staffing changes, we had 100% turnover in the staff that we had to rehabilitate the agency. When we did that, we took several looks at the entirety of our programming and our processes and implemented procedures, processes, practices, three Kaizen events, ultimately to get to ensuring that we were enforcing the statute in the way that we're obligated to. The complaints obviously are classified as confidential data, but in aggregate, the increase in complaints is attributed to us, the Minnesota Board of Psychology, receiving self-disclosures and self-reports by applicants for licensure, as well as supervisors involved in the licensure process, as well as individuals who were seeking licensure who hadn't sought it before, disclosing information that implied violations of the Practice Act in how they were being supervised in their work settings, as well as how they were not being supervised in many cases.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Barnes, what would be the percent or what number out of those complaints culminated into disciplinary action?
Ms. Barnes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Albright. None of those, which are the complaints, if you're talking about just the percentage of the increase, or are you talking about all of our complaints overall?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Barnes, all complaints.
Out of all of the complaints, I do not know off the top of, you know, off sitting here. I don't have the statistics, but we do publish all of our disciplinary and corrective actions online.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Barnes, I note that over the course of the last couple of years, you've had an increase in the number of staff as well, obviously because of turnover, but also an increase in the IT budget. It would seem to me that your efforts would be to streamline the process through IT measures. My question is, why would there be a need for the increased expansion of the staff as well at the same time that you're trying to streamline the process through IT?
Ms. Barnes.
Chair, Senator Albright. Certainly, I think that's a very good question, and I think that when we look at the work of the board, we were entirely paper-based when I arrived in 2009. Our board opted to be the pilot program for the e-licensing program and implemented a database over the last 2 years, which did automate, add the efficiencies, provide all online access to all services offered by the board, including complaint submission as well as licensure. At the time I arrived, we had approximately 9 staff members. We're down to 8.5. We did go up to 10. At some point during between 2009 and present, and that's attributable to while we streamlined processes electronically to become more efficient and more timely, that allowed us to free up the talents and expertise of the staff we brought on board and expand into a whole new area in terms of education, programming, outreach, and development. So, for example, we use staff instead of reviewing pages and pages of paper or hand grading bubble exams. We use those staff members now to go into the graduate program and teach an all-day ethics course at no cost, on the Board of Psychology and how ethical obligations operate in conjunction with the American Psychological Association model as well. So we're using our resources in a way that adds more value to Minnesota citizens as opposed to how we were before in terms of the staffing unit to push paper. We weren't doing those activities before. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Barnes, final question then, in terms of if you are now having your renewals and the applications being online and being more of an automatic process that the applicants can handle themselves, I would expect that that would endear yourself to a decrease in the staffing function. I guess I'm wondering just in terms of what the staff you have, if they're not doing the part of the renewals, is it justifiable to suggest that all of that is going towards ongoing continuing education programming? If you're only doing it once and then sending it out through a matter of the same IT function, per se, that you're going to automate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Albright, I'm going to use a primary example. We had one part-time 0.8 state program administrator who processed by hand the renewals. Renewals are automated. They are done by licensees online at a 96% rate. That state program administrator now is responsible for coordinating all of the educational programming requests. We do over 16 different presentations a year, both state and national, coordinating these requests, developing the team on that, as well as planning an annual all-day free continuing education opportunity for licensees in the state. So that requires contracting, vending, speakers, purchasing. So she's managing all of those, as well as doing pre-approval of continuing education. She also registers continuing education sponsors, as well as managing the continuing education CE audits, which began in 2013. So we definitely have plenty of work to do that wasn't being done adequately before, and so we've moved her to more efficient use. So simply freeing up renewals to a database system that automates it is great, and that's a more efficient use of our time, but we definitely have areas to address. So
Mr. Chair and Ms. Barnes, then, given that answer, then there's no expectation of a fee increase for those that subscribe to the board.
Ms. Barnes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Albright, absolutely not. We don't anticipate any fee increase whatsoever. We have the sufficient revenue in the special revenue fund to fund all of our change item requests. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes.
Other questions for Ms. Barnes? I just had one, just in terms of, and this is our last presentation, so we're going to finish early. Just in looking at complaints from the published data that we all get, what percentage of complaints are just within psychology, and I would imagine it would be similar within the other allied health fields, would be behavioral in nature for the behavior of the licensee, and how much would it be just in terms of licensure itself and applications and kind of bureaucratic stuff versus personal stuff? How does that break down generally?
Definitely. Mr. Chair, when we look at our complaint data, we used to have about 140 complaints a year. A majority of those were, I will call them non-technical. So sort of into technical violations is what you referred to, like the licensure process and some of those things versus behavioral-based. So if you're talking about conduct, sexual behavior with a client or some of those concerning behaviors, I would say I think we had 76 total. And that could be up a little or down a little, approximately 78 instances of technical over the last year versus the rest being behavioral. Majority of our complaints are boundary violations and boundary crossings by providers with their clients, as well as inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety, so we might be looking at chemical dependency and mental health issues as well.
Thank you. I know that I was on an airplane next to a board member, not in your board, but in another health board. And it's kind of a, tour of duty to have to be on those boards and to do that, and it's kind of a service thing. I really appreciate all the work that they do. But one of the parts of that that is not so fun is to have to sanction other colleagues in the profession. And growing percentage of the complaints, at least according to this board member, were on personal behavioral chemical addiction issues. Is there, within your board, what happens if somebody is, let's say that they've, there's a complaint and there's, let's say, an evaluation that's done. Are there resources within the board to help people with addiction and with those kinds of things to get them back on track? Or is that generally within their profession and within their site where they work? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, excellent question. When our board is dealing with what we call inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety, so that could be any of those addiction or chemical health issues that you mentioned, first we review the complaint and make an immediate determination as to whether there's imminent risk to the risk of harm to the public. Absent a finding of imminent risk, at which time we would have done a temporary suspension of the license, we then work with the individual we can make a board referral to our Health Professional Services Program, which is a program operated by the Health-Related Licensing Boards and funded by the Health-Related Licensing Boards to monitor. It's a confidential monitoring program for individuals who suffer from either mental health issues or chemical dependency-related issues. And provided that they do enroll in that program and sign a participation agreement and are successful, they are able to go through that program in a confidential manner. However, should they violate that participation agreement, the Health Professional Services Program does refer them back to their board for additional action, and then we would be looking at what tools we have in our toolbox. So, for example, should we opt with disciplinary action, we may incorporate in that disciplinary action several remedial pieces. We may ask that they go to treatment, demonstrate sobriety, seek therapy, and a variety of things that can be supports for them. And certainly we want them to be well, so starting with HPSP is a good option to have.
And if you catch people far enough upstream, would it be accurate to say that if somebody self-reports, says, hey, I've got a problem with this, I need to catch this early, that they could do so before that was made public, or even if they were referred, that could, in fact, so that would not be made public, or is everything public if it's a referral?
So, Mr. Chair, there's about, I would approximate it to be about three ways you could get to HPSB. One is the individual provider themselves, if they are under the jurisdiction of a board, licensee, they can call HPSB themselves and make a self-report. In that case, the board has no information or identifying data that would tell them that they've done that, nor is it public. It is a confidential program that they could self-enroll in and complete. In the event that it comes to the attention of the board and we were to make a referral, we can make that referral in two ways. We can send the individual a letter or correspondence saying that they need to demonstrate that they have enrolled in the Health Professional Services Program by proof of the participation agreement. And at that point, we would in general close the complaint and allow them to proceed through HPSP. That's also a situation where it does not become public data, nor does the board obtain data throughout the monitoring process. Should we find an individual who is unwilling or reaches a threshold that we definitely need them to be there and we need accountability, we may use a disciplinary action to refer them. We call it referring on order. In that circumstance, that document would be a public accessible document that would support the basis for why they're there.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right, seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your presentation. And that concludes our review for the budget proposal presentations for boards. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 9th, and we're going to, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, this is just a general question. It doesn't apply specifically to anything we've heard. But, you know, trying to think how I should ask the question is, when I was on the school board many years ago now, one of the things I noticed is that there were penalties if certain groups in the school board, including the general fund, accumulated too much money. In other words, we had to pay it back to the state. So there was this incentive each year or two to make sure you spent all the money to stay under a certain amount or to be out of money so you could ask for more from the school board the next year. And, you know, it was a bone of contention for me to see this happening. And I'm just wondering, at the state level, how do we monitor that? Is there actually penalties if you accumulate too much money in one of these boards or agencies? Do we monitor if there's a sudden spending of money right at the end to make sure that we're out of money so we can come? Not that I think anybody would do that. But, you know, I do have a little suspicion of human nature. But, I mean, after hearing all these testimonies about the need for more money, for some reason I started thinking about that. And so it's just a general question. I don't know if anybody has any feedback.
Thanks, Representative Grunhagen. I know that for all of the boards that we've gone through in the book, they're all, you pay for your license, the check goes to the board, they accumulate a budget, and it is within that practice, and they tend to be fairly small numbers of folks, as you've seen with that, the headcount. So it's a fairly small item. We can follow up with MMB to look at what the protocol is for the accumulation. You know, if board practices are growing in numbers, they get their money from checks for membership. As you can see, I don't think we saw a single fee increase yet this year. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm not talking necessarily about what we just heard, the different boards, but even the agencies in general. It's just a general question. When I look at the HHS budget, and when we had previous testimonies in other meetings, one of the questions I consistently ask was, what's your projected rate of growth in the, you know, on a per year basis? And the responses I remember were 5, 6, 7, 8% in their particular areas per year. Well, if you multiply that, we're talking about double digit increases in every area of the HHS budget, which I think all of us would agree is simply unsustainable when we look at the growth of the private economy and its ability to generate more and more tax dollars. So that's one of the things that concerns me, is that there's some type of monitoring and check and balance on these agency expenditures, and that there isn't this incentive to actually make sure you spend all the money so you can ask for more. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not saying anybody's doing that, but the thought occurred to me after having watched how the school board operated it for a number of years. So.
Yeah. Yep. I think they tend to be small in number. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Grunhagen, at least just in terms of the health licensing boards, I think what we've been hearing and what the process is, and the testifier can correct me if I'm mistaken, but you know, they're getting the licensing fees that's going into a special revenue account. They have to have an appropriation to spend it. So they are, in fact, accumulating sometimes extra dollars, and then you're hearing them come here and justify why they want to maybe spend a little more of that money that's been accumulated. So it is in no way the kind of process that you're talking about. It's kind of the opposite of that process for these licensing boards, right? She's shaking her head, so kind of got the right. And then they have to also have authority to raise their fees.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, a lot of them are telling us we haven't raised our fee since, you know, whenever. So that's a piece of this, too, because the fees are supposed to cover their expenditures. So I know you're asking a broader question,
mm-hmm.
and I think, part of the answer might be it depends. because they do things differently throughout different parts of the budget, and probably Mr. Berg would be better to answer it comprehensively. But, you know, some of our expenditures, like what you all passed with the nursing homes, putting the nursing homes in a basically a forecast situation. They don't have to do that because whatever the costs are, quote unquote, is going to be used to calculate what they're going to receive. So they're going to just be, it's going to be rising because you're going to continuously be basing it on costs. I don't know that there's lots of incentive there to control the costs because of that. Other areas of the budget is probably different. I mean, maybe Mr. Berg could comment on what the agency budgets do as opposed to programs that are forecast or, you know, other things.
Not that I want to drag out the meeting, but...
That's all right.
So, Mr. Chair, could Mr. Berg just make a comment?
Well, I don't really want to open up the entirety of the budget at this point. I think we're pretty well done with the boards right now. We will be back Thursday, February 9th. We'll mop up on the DHS budget, so it should hopefully be another shorter meeting on Thursday. We will see. With that, we are adjourned.